Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable on this Friday, the 11th of April. And it's very nice to have you. I will tell you just a little bit, a personal observation, that it is unsettling, even though I sort of know what's going on. It's unsettling to walk in and see the CEO here. I'm like, oh boy, I'm gonna get publicly flogged. But it's very nice, very, very nice to have you here. We have guests in the studio this morning. I have an announcement to make and some exciting things that are happening and some things that are developing that we want you to know about. And so we're very excited. We have Sarah Gilbert, who is the CEO of this wonderful organization, and has been, you know, it's going to be a year before you know it.
That is true. And hello, everybody. Good morning. Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. It's wonderful to have you here. We also welcome Peter Hughes to the program, and we're thrilled to have Peter with us, who has a large role in this announcement this morning. So we're excited about that as well.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Good. Thanks for having us.
All right. So, you know, what I basically want to know to lead you into this is, do I need to buy new luggage?
No, you're fine. Your pigskin luggage can say exactly where it is.
Very good.
You're okay.
Thank you. No satchel or anything?
No.
Why would I need that?
Yes, not today. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go. No. So thank you very much for giving us a little bit of your time this morning, roundtablers. We have some exciting news to share. If you are an observant listener and member at WOMC, you will know that we have been piloting some exciting events out and around the community, coming out to meet you, you know, where you are. And today we're sharing the news that we are going all formal and properly launching our new project, which is called WAMC On The Road. And this is our way of busting out of the studio. Not that there's anything wrong with the studio. It has its place. No. But we also want to be...
I've been trying to bust out for years.
Yeah, yeah. You're not going anywhere. And so we're busting out of the studio and coming out into the community. We're going to meet you all where you are, in theatres, in libraries, in shopping malls, in people's living rooms, wherever you happen to be living your life. And we want to talk to you about what's top of mind. We want to entertain you with beautiful cultural events. We are basically coming to meet you. And we're so excited about this. It feels like it's front and center for us as a public media organization to be out there and supporting healthy, vibrant communities at this moment. So we're really pleased to be here.
So let's put on a show.
We're going to put on a show. And the events we've already done under the development wing of WAMC On The Road. We did the incredible Vox Pop on March 26th, where we were around down in Rhinecliff, and we did the absolutely wonderful Vox Pop Live Presents, which I think is going to air on next Food
That's
Friday,
right,
with Ray Graff and Gail Sokol. We are working on another Vox roundtable on the end of this month, on the 30th. I hope that's not news to you here, Joe. More details on that soon. Coming out to your community. And we're working with the incredible Mona Golub on Music Haven events in Schenectady in the beautiful Central Park, my old stomping grounds. So be able to go out and do all the great work we do at WAMC face-to-face and not from just behind a soundproof booth.
Yeah.
And really meet people and bring that content and those communities together is where we ought to go, where public radio should go, and it's super exciting.
I'd just like to say two things. One, I don't want to speak on behalf of my colleague, Ray Graff, but I love going out and meeting people. It is absolutely wonderful. It's so much fun. It is, it's great. It's spirited. And the thing that always amazes me, and I've said this before, but it always amazes me, you go out and you say to the assembled masses, have you ever been to one of these events before? And mostly, it's all new hands, which means people are coming out and word of mouth, and that's just lovely, absolutely lovely. Obviously, you were talking about the development wing.
Mm.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in the development
wing. Yeah.
it's nice.
They let you out with good behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and they took the jacket off, so it's nice.
Yeah.
So that is all good. Now, what I have learned in life is that sometimes when you do incredible things, there are certain let's use the word loosely, sacrifices that have to be made as to allow you to do fully what you want to do.
Yes, that's right. Change is change, and there are fabulous things about it, and then some bittersweet things. And the little bittersweet aspect to the news that we're sharing today is that we are going to be closing the Linda later this year. It's a beautiful building. She has been incredibly kind to us. We've had some wonderful times there. But the truth is that we serve a tiny fraction of our enormous audience across our wonderful, bright, vibrant region with a building. And so it's, at the end of the day, it's not about a building. It's about us being out in the community, talking with you guys, learning what you want to tell us, hearing all of your feedback, and creating community together out there in the world. So that's what we're focused on.
Yeah, certainly it's bittersweet.
Yeah.
And no one feels that more than I do.
Yeah.
But we're...
Hey, do you still have a job?
Let's answer that now. This would be the
sure
most. This would be the most glorious firing to ever happen live on air.
Okay.
It's bittersweet. We are super proud of all the work we've done, the friends we've made, the memories we've collected, and all the music and programming that we've done. All of that still is fantastic and wonderful. But we're even more excited at this point to go out on the road and do all of that incredible work out in the communities where people are. Yes, I am still have a job. Nathan Scheid, our TD, still have a job. We're going to be developing and running on the road. So doing all that great work in new rooms, new spaces, new communities, and bringing all that together.
You know what I've learned already in this process as the development wing, as you call it, is that there are we have so many incredible partners, so many wonderful
That's right.
people that we've known for years and years and years and decades, and who are there and are opening their arms and welcoming us, and it's really quite lovely.
Yeah, it really is. And I just, you know, Peter and Nathan, close your ears, Peter, but they are fabulous event producers, and
yes.
it's really exciting to be able to go out into the community and just explore what we can do with those partners, because there's so much possibility. And of course, talking of partners, you know, AMC is still at the heart of Albany. We are still very much committed to the communities where we have bureaus. We are not going anywhere. And we will work with the city. We're in talks with the city to make sure that we find the best reuse for the building as well. So it's a beautiful building, and we're looking forward to welcoming our new neighbors.
It's a gorgeous place, and it is. I think it will continue to serve the community as it has in its various forms over
yeah.
the many, many decades, which is a pretty gorgeous thing. I know you've all been very busy with this, and congratulations, and it's it all seems really good. It's very exciting.
Yeah.
So, as you said, bittersweet, because we do love the place, but it's also very nice, and we can't wait. I may just get luggage anyway.
Okay, fine. Just don't expense it.
No, I won't. Get something a little more presentable. You both are great. I thank you so much. Peter Hughes, congratulations on this.
Thank you very much.
On this new role and putting this together. I look forward very much to working with you on these events. And as you said, the first one that we'll be doing together is on the 30th, and details to come on that. And I'll just give you a hint. It's really cool. And we're very excited about that. And Sarah Gilbert, our CEO, you're just amazing. I have such Aww. Respect for what you have done and coming in and thinking and listening to us and listening to the community and working with the community. And it's a beautiful result. And I thank you very, very much for all the hard work.
Oh, you are most welcome. And thanks in return, Brother Joe. And happy paneling.
We had an economist outside, man. We got stuff to talk about. We'll see if we can afford any of this.
There may be news.
Yeah. There may... a delight to see you both. Thank you very much for dropping by. Best of luck in the efforts. By the way, we should say that if anyone has any questions or anything and you want to, either through the comment line or through Peter or Sarah, reach out, and they would be more than happy to answer any questions or concerns. And if you're already planning an event for us to come, just give us like 3 days. And then fine. That'll be great.
Yeah. That's a fine.
We're looking for partners.
Right?
Yeah, we're looking for partners. Absolutely. Thank you both. Be well. We'll take a quick break and be back with the panel right after this. Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning we have quite a panel. Little news that we had to break, and then we get into the mechanics of the show and talk about what's going on in our complicated world. We're going to 11 o'clock this morning. We welcome you, and we thank you very much for being with us on this Friday morning. Let me introduce the group to you. We won't wait any longer than that, so we get everybody in. Bob Bellafiore is here, communications expert and founder, president of Stanhope Partners. Bob, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. How are you today?
I'm good. Really good to see you.
Really good to be seen.
I enjoy when you're on the program. I enjoy that you're here, and I thank you very much for doing that. Teresa Bourgeois is with us, public policy and communications expert. Good morning, Teresa. How are you? Oh, there you go. I'm sorry. The mic is a little.
As long as I don't read the news, I'm good.
Yeah, that's all right. We'll work on that during the break. How are you?
Well, you know, I'm okay.
Okay.
As long as I don't pay attention to the substance of what's going on in the world, I'm fine.
Yeah, there's that. To help make some sense of that, we thought it would be good to have an absolute expert and a legend in the studio this morning. And we are very thrilled to have Chairman and Chief Investment Officer of Hugh Johnson Advisors in Albany, the one and only Hugh Johnson. What a delight to have you back on the program. Thanks so much.
It's great. It's great. It's obviously great to be here to make with my two friends here to make sense out of something that nobody can make much sense out of. So if we're talking about the global economy and all that's going on, I'll need all the help I can get.
Well, we'll try to muddle through together. So we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. If you would like to join us, any questions that you have, any thoughts that you have, anything you'd like to share. So, initially, there were points, various points in this week, as you know, it's just been all over the place. And at the point when the tariffs were paused, and I thought, oh, well, I know Hugh will be on Friday, and maybe we can, even though things are cooling down a little bit, we can just sort of look and say, oh, you know, this is the week that we had, and get an idea of what that is, and maybe with a couple of days of perspective. But that hasn't been the case, and it was the market went nuts after the announcement, and then yesterday things cooled, and now there's the issues with China raising tariffs on the U.S. to 125%, as the New York Times calls it, a tit-for-tat trade war that is escalating. And that retaliation comes after the White House raised its levy on Chinese goods to 125% on top of an existing 20% tax. There's a point, Hugh Johnson, where I don't even know what that means.
Well, what it means is, of course, is that they're raising tariffs. And if you try to send things to China, there's an import tariff on what you send to China. It becomes more expensive, and the vice versa, obviously. As China sends things here, there's a tariff on what they send here. And so prices, the first thing that happens during a tariff trade war, is that we see prices start to go up domestically in the U.S., and we see higher rates of inflation, and that brings all sorts of issues to bear on the course on the Federal Reserve when they see inflation, unfortunately, again starting to rise. So it creates a very difficult situation. I might add that we're talking about, yes, China up to 125% on the U.S. At the same time, in this tit-for-tat world, you're also seeing the U.S. scramble, I guess is the right word, to try to do deals, is the way I think you have to put it right at this point, with 70 other countries which are going to be facing higher tariffs. We're talking about 10% tariffs now. We're not talking about the reciprocal tariffs, which would have been much higher and much more dangerous. But this is the 10% tariffs, and there are a lot of countries that are faced with that, and it's going to be tough for them. And now the administration is trying to, I don't want to use the word, but help those countries by negotiating with those countries. I think the important thing, though, out of all of this is that the tariffs right now look as though they're being imposed primarily as a negotiating tactic. Yes, we do want higher tariffs, but we don't want significantly higher taxes, tariffs, in order to try to wreak havoc for the not only U.S. economy, but for the global economy. So negotiating tactic, I think that's important, and it's important for lots of reasons.
So I want to get into that and ask a specific question about negotiation. But before I do that, let me just get a big question that I have out of the way more than anything else, which is, this is a pause. It's a 90-day pause. Is that in and of itself problematic? Because it seems that we're pausing a turbulent situation. Does that not just allow us to be in more turbulence for the next 3 months?
Not necessarily, because remember, the administration is trying to negotiate some sort of a tariff with 70 other countries. So during this pause, things are going to get done, hopefully, cross your fingers, and that we're going to negotiate tariffs in a way that tariffs are going to come down and not be as difficult for the global economy.
Is this the way to do that? I mean, is this the model way to do that? You've been in this game for a long time. Have you ever seen anything like this?
Yes, I have seen something like this. Okay. And I think I would invite everybody to take a look back at the 2018-2019 trade war. And that played out in a certain way. I call it stage one and stage two. We're still in stage one. But it played out in a way that I think is a good model for what this one's going to play out. And one part of the 2018-2019 trade war, very significant part, was the so-called negotiations that went on at that time primarily between the U.S. and China. So negotiations were a part of that. As a result, it didn't last forever, and we came out of it in reasonably good shape. Negotiations are a part of this, and there's a chance that on the basis of those negotiations, we'll come out of this in relatively good shape. And when I say relatively good shape, that won't cause economic havoc in the U.S. as well as the rest of the globe.
I want to let your colleagues in on this discussion in just a moment. But one is, there's some question as to what the status is of these negotiations. I understand it's with a lot of countries, but as far as what is actively being done, that still seems to be a question. But then, how do you and can you and will they properly, and we can decide what that means properly, negotiate with China?
We've been negotiating with China for a long time. They're very much a part of, the, of course, the first trade war, 2018-2019, not only a part of it, but they were the principal focus, and we've had tariffs on China ever since then, and including they were extended by the Biden administration. So China and the U.S., the negotiations between China and the U.S., let's just say they're ongoing. And are they going to continue to be ongoing after the so-called 90 days? You bet they'll be ongoing. It's going to be a struggle, which I think, my guess, is that it's going to be ongoing for a long period of time as they both struggle for, let's call it, global leadership.
So go ahead. Teresa Bourgeois.
It's a question. 2018, you mentioned. Can you just, for those who don't know, was it this many? Were there this many countries involved at that time? And were our allies involved to the extent that they are now? I don't recall that. So could you refresh our memory?
It's a great question, Teresa. And I can't really give you a good answer because I didn't look that closely at it, closely enough to say that it was primarily the U.S. and China at that time, although Canada and Mexico were certainly a part of what was going on, the negotiations on tariffs between countries around the world. But it was nowhere near as extensive as this was in the terms of the number of countries. But also importantly, and I think this is well worth keeping in mind, not just simply the number of countries, but the extent of the tariffs themselves. We're talking about 10% universal tariffs now. But the real problem was potentially where the pause is on the reciprocal tariffs. And those were very extensive, so large, and I hate to say this, but so large that they compared with the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of 1930, which led to the Depression.
Right.
And so I think it's both the number of countries as well as the magnitude of the tariffs, which makes this importantly different. But even though it's different, I think it's going to, and this is a little bit subtle, it's going to play out, I think, in somewhat of a similar manner to what happened in 2018-19 as far as what's going to happen to inflation, longer-term interest rates, Federal Reserve policy, stock prices in phase one, and then we have stage two, what's going to happen during that stage, where then we'll start to see inflation coming down, we'll see the Federal Reserve reducing rates, long rates coming down, and stock prices, surprisingly, doing well in stage two of the of this trade war. I'm hoping that the model works this time, despite the fact that there are more countries and more significant tariffs.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Just one question, and then yes, absolutely, of course. But I a follow-up. But so you the way you talk about this is in very measured tones, and thankfully because you make me feel better. But I will say as you described this, it seems as though there was some master plan that was afoot, and that this was put into action, and this was exactly what we were expecting. As I sat here and panels sat here over the last couple of days, it didn't feel like that. It felt like it was just the Wild West, and we were, you know, this would happen one minute, this would happen the next minute, and we were all over the place. So are both things true?
Master plan. A master plan in the mind of Donald Trump. That's the extent of the master plan. He's been absorbed by, or obsessed by, is probably the right word, the idea of tariffs and equalizing or leveling out the playing field, as he would say. It was completely misguided, but nevertheless, leveling the playing field. And that's been in his mind. But then there have been a few people that have been involved with him that have sort of structured all of the tariffs, talked about. I mentioned the 10% universal. I mentioned the reciprocal tariffs. Who structured that? And you saw that long list of countries with their current imports and exports or their tariffs, and then the tariffs that we would impose as a part of the reciprocal tariffs. That was so misguided. It almost takes words out of my mouth. But anyway, all of that was kind of an on-again, off-again. Here we are, and there we are, and was concocted, I think, as best I can guess, was concocted as a sort of a last-minute thing by some people that were not particularly, didn't have extensive experience in the whole subject of tariffs. He had a person working for him in this first administration, Robert Lighthizer, who was really good at this. And he has a couple of people at the Secretary of the Treasury. I think it's pretty competent. He has some people, but overall, candidly, from what little I know, and I know a little bit more, but from what I do know, I'm certainly not overly impressed with the way the reciprocal tariffs were put together or figured out or mathematically composed.
Teresa.
Well, the other question, this is a world I just don't know, so these are
not
really
many
questions.
Do.
The long list question, because there is 3 months, so that's a pause that's important. But as I was reading, each one of these is a complex trade negotiation. And can you really deal with 70 countries individually, set up separate deals in just 3 months? And particularly with, it seems like the advisors are going in 3 or 4 different directions. Well, the trade rep seems to be out of the loop. Bessent's going in one direction, 2 of the others in a different. So how do you really, in 3 months, when you have 70 different countries, do that?
You're absolutely right. They cannot be done in 3 months or 90 days. That's not enough time. But you can reach a memo of understanding between yourselves, U.S., and that country to sort of start or launch the most important phase, which is when the actual deal or tariffs are put together, negotiated and put together. And hopefully, and this is what you hope for, is that there's a memo of understanding which leads to some sort of a give or reduction, and sensible reduction, in the level of the tariffs, so it's not going to have significant inflation and economic damage. That's the first thing you hope for. And then, of course, you go through the process of negotiating and get an agreement. Is it going to be done? It can be done, but it's going to take a very long time. First, you get the agreement, the memo of understanding. That's number one. That can be done in 90 days. And then you got to move on to the actual tough part, which is actually negotiating the tariffs, which are extraordinarily complex, especially when you get past the tariff stage and you get into things like the VAT taxes and you get into things like currency manipulation. Then it becomes extraordinarily complex, difficult for me and most people to understand.
Bob Bellafiore.
boy, I love going after this because I have to keep a mental list of all the things I want to talk about. Hugh, you said people are going to, if you're expecting any kind of stability, right? There is no stability when Donald Trump is around. He is a large rear fin on a great white shark. He does nothing but do this all the time and agitates the waters.
You're moving your hand to the left and the right.
Yeah. I'm being like a rear fin of a great white shark.
His hand. He's moving
right.
His hand.
You did describe it well.
Yeah. I mean, he is always agitating. He is always poking beehives. That is the way he has always been. He is, as Saul Alinsky would say, he is flooding the zone with stuff. Right? Hugh, you hit the nail on the head when you said this is a negotiation, right? And in a negotiation, right, you've been in high-stakes financial negotiations. Everybody has bought a house. You know what it's like. In a governmental political context, one, you can juggle 70 balls at once. You have to when you're the White House in the United States, because all of these things are like a giant spider web, right? That's what geopolitical economics and everything is. It's a giant spider web. You pull one thread, the other thread moves. They're all interacting. You can't deal with anyone in isolation because they all have reverberations on other things. The way negotiations work is, and I learned this best from 8 years with Governor Pataki, you decide where you want to go. What does victory look like? What does the end look like? And then you start on that path. You propose a way, other people propose a way. And people do things in the midst of it, and you need to constantly adapt to what other people do. But it's a negotiation. If you pay attention to every little step in a negotiation, you will be, Joel, like you said people were this week, feeling like it's not good, right? Feelings are irrational, right? Feelings are, and part of the problem with the country.
Or maybe it's not. Oh, sorry.
Part of the problem with the United States right now is people are so focused on feelings. Right. I'm not trying to be hard hearted, but, you know, it doesn't feel right to me. Well, fine. You know,
well,
preparing for a colonoscopy doesn't feel right to me either.
I mean, they're worried about their Social Security. They're worried about their 401ks, their 403bs. They're worried about their future. They're worried about their retirement. They're worried about their kids, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
So I think it's more than a feeling. I think it's
well, what's
it's
worry? Worry is a feeling.
Yeah. No, but I think it's genuine fear. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, farmers.
It's a feeling.
Here,
let me
some
say
facts,
something.
Bob.
Let me say, these are feelings are a big part of this, but obviously that makes it very soft and elusive and difficult to sort of pin down as to what we're talking about. I've always found in my profession that the financial markets or investors collectively, not individually, but collectively, often get it right. In other words, they get it right as to where we're headed for the economy and where we're headed for inflation and where we're headed for Federal Reserve policy. So what I'm just simply saying is that, you know, I understand it's elusive, but at the same time, if you want to sort of quantify where we're headed, where the U.S. is headed, where the global economy is headed, where things are headed, take a look at the performance of the financial markets. Well, financial markets will probably get it right. It won't be immediate, but it'll probably, I know. Like I saw
okay,
that
but
chart. That's,
can I ask then?
Yeah, you bet.
Because I heard people talking about this last night. Again, not an expert, so I'm trying to read. And the bond markets are doing something that they don't typically do. Typically, when you have a stock sell-off, people move to safety in bonds. But they are not, which the experts that I listened to last night said, and I'd like to hear you on this because I'm not, said that's a really serious warning sign. It says that they have lost confidence in the dollar and so that they are not buying treasuries. And is it not unusual to not go to bonds when you're selling stocks?
No,
and that's a serious, scary signal.
It is a little bit troubling, but it's not that troubling if you think about it. And that is, when you see the financial markets performing, which as you're describing, where stocks are going down, bonds are going up, and interest rates are coming down. And we've seen that periodically over the last month or so. The message from the financial markets collectively, and that's important, not only stocks going down, but you see interest rates going down, and periodically we've had that. We've also had the opposite, but we've had that. What that message is fairly clear, is that investors are very concerned that something fundamental is happening, and it raises significant dangers for the U.S. economy. What it really effectively means is that stocks are going down because the economy will suffer and earnings will do poorly. That's part of the story. But it's also saying that stocks, that interest rates are going down because in time, what's going to happen with interest rates going down is the reflection of problems in the economy, which means that in time, interest rates are going down, but the Federal Reserve will have to step up and lower short-term interest rates to try to help the economy. And both are very consistent. In other words, stocks going down because of worries and concerns about the economy, and interest rates going down because of deep worries and concerns about the economy. That's what ordinarily happens, especially when those worries and concerns are very deep. If they're not that deep, then you get what you might call normal, which is stocks will go down, but bonds will...
Because they usually go in opposite.
Not always. Look at history.
What if China retaliates by not buying our treasuries as they typically do?
Well, they typically do, because don't forget...
Don't they hold an enormous amount of our debt?
They hold an enormous amount, which is one of the reasons why they're going to continue to buy U.S. treasuries. In other words, countries that say, gee, we're going to swear off buying treasuries or helping finance. This is an important issue, incidentally. But when they say they're going to swear off buying issues, they're really stuck. They can't really do that. Because if they do that, if China backs away from the markets, or if the European Union backs away from the markets and you have fewer buyers, what is going to happen to interest rates? Interest rates are going to have to find other buyers, or it's going to be difficult, and interest rates are going to go up. Well, who does that hurt? It hurts China. It hurts Europe. It hurts all those people that have been funding or financing our deficits for so long. Now, you raise a really interesting issue because this gets a little bit complex. And that is...
As opposed to the other stuff,
yeah,
which is the
easy stuff.
Yeah, the fly rule.
I really apologize for all that. But at any rate,
helping them immensely.
Well,
it's
very interesting.
But
and
this
that is,
idea that
don't,
China
don't forget,
could...
Don't forget. There's a purpose behind raising money by imposing tariffs. And part of that is to raise revenues for the federal government in Washington. Why are they raising revenues for the federal government?
To pay for their tax bill.
To pay for the tax bill. To pay for the extension of the 2017 tax.
That's what this is all about.
All
he's
right.
Tanking our economy to raise tax.
That's going to cost $3 trillion
which
over 10
afford.
Years. Where's that money going to come from? Well, part of it's going to come from U.S. investors, but part of it's going to come from foreign investors. Are foreign investors going to be anxious to step up to the plate and buy U.S. treasuries? This gets to what you're talking about. Are they going to be anxious to step up to the plate and buy U.S. treasuries? Well, probably less so if you're putting tariffs on the products that they're trying to sell to the U.S. So that's a really great question, and it's a really important one. But remember, the purpose of the tariffs, or the ultimate purpose, in my judgment, is to raise revenues, to finance the reduction in taxes, and that's going to be made much more difficult if you're telling those countries that have been financing our deficits, that have been buying our treasuries, that you're going to have to pay big tariffs.
Do we have a timeline on that? Like, how long does that take?
Trump would like to get it done really quickly.
Yes.
Do we have a timeline? It's a guessing game.
Yeah.
It's 10 years of $3 trillion, and that doesn't even count the amount we're going to have to pay in interest over that 10 years, which is $467 billion. These are not my estimates. I wouldn't do that work.
And
it's the Congressional Budget Office.
And the House and Senate have just passed a framework where they have got the Republicans on the right to agree by saying that we're going to have deep, deep cuts, including in Medicare and Social Security. And they've got the Republicans more to the center to agree by saying we won't touch Medicaid or Social Security.
They got to raise the revenues.
They promised the same thing to both. Or maybe he needs to change his tax package, because basically he tanked our 401ks to get enough money to get his tax package.
You sound like a Democrat. I mean, the point is, the Democrats are saying exactly that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, because I do not want to sound like the sane washing of like, he's just
a good negotiator.
I'm sorry, Bob.
Absolutely right. He's trying to do a lot and extending
he's
the
trying to get the tax breaks. Why doesn't he cut the subsidies to oil, his oil and gas buddies?
That's what the tariffs are
He could
for.
Get some money if he did that.
If you look at the record,
record,
he did cut the subsidies to wind and solar.
If you look at the record of 2017, it ain't going to raise enough revenues.
Absolutely not. That's why we have these deep deficits.
All right. So let me ask this question.
I got a little testy there.
No, you're...
No.
I'm just being me. I'm doing
it. The day ends in Y.
All All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I have some follow-up questions. I know the rest of the gang, I want to hear from Bob as well. We'll take a break. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Hugh Johnson is here, Teresa Bourgeois, Bob Bellafiore. We'll continue right after this. You know, Teresa, I think there's a difference between testy and passionate.
Thank you so much. That's very nice. I appreciate that.
I will, and we'll accept all of this. I think we're all passionate about this.
I feel deeply about this.
Realms of trying to understand it. Because, go ahead.
I don't want to interrupt you. I have like 10 questions.
I have two questions. One is getting into to a slightly different subject, but you just hit on it. And so there's an article in the Wall Street Journal today that says the market rout shatters long held beliefs on investing. And this is basically an article about how normally financial advisors would tell their clients. The habit would be that you stay invested no matter how rocky the markets get. And this article, again, in the Wall Street Journal, is saying that this is testing that to a point where people like yourselves, not you, but others, that are, as they are accustomed to watching the stock markets, have just say, wait. Wait, 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 and that this is making that difficult to do. So I don't know what to make of this.
The only thing to make of it is, look, we have I've looked at all the markets since 1890. There have been corrections, 26 of them, and there have been 26 bear markets. The corrections are about 19%. The bear markets are averaging about 35%, with a big steep one in there in 1930. Okay, this one is if you do the arithmetic, is about 17%. First of all, it hadn't lasted very long.
We haven't found the bottom yet, though, right?
I don't think so, but that's a guess. I don't know.
We don't know.
I don't think we have seen a bottom yet, but the point is, when we get there, I don't know, okay? But the point being is that look, you're just getting started. And it may go longer and it may go deeper, but does that mean that your belief that if you hold on to good companies, that we won't have this won't end?
Well, it's too late
baloney.
To sell now. Though, right?
It's going to end someday. And does that mean that those stocks that you hold, which are hopefully good stocks, good even technology names like Apple? But even if you hold on to them, does that mean that they're not going to, at some point, recover and do reasonably well? The record is really clear that the long-term record, as Bob has pointed out to us in our break, is pretty positive. And in time, I would bet that record is going to be resumed, and that people that hold on to stocks are probably going to do quite well. That's a lesson I've learned. Being in this business for as long as I've been in this business, and I learned it from some pretty, in some ways boring, but very savvy professionals, and they've been right.
You mentioned you've analyzed every market since 1890. Now you were on the trading floor in 1890 when that started, right? I mean, I just wanted to confirm that you've
nice.
Seen each
no,
one of
no,
these
they
personally.
Were, nice. They, no, they were no. I was a faint dream. Actually, yeah. It wasn't even in 1890. 1907 when I was a dream, a fantasy.
Very good. Here's the thing, right? Fear and worry is a tremendous motivating factor. That's what political campaigns do. They make you afraid of the other candidate to motivate you to do things.
Certainly Trump does.
What's that?
Certainly Trump does. It's not everybody's strategy, but that's his.
Come on, every candidate who's run since Thomas Jefferson has used fear and negative campaigning to make you freak out. He does that very well.
No, I mean, he really had. I'm not saying a bad thing. I'm saying it's his strategy that has worked for him.
It is a bad thing.
Okay, this show is too much noun verb Trump, right? It's noun verb Trump, right? I'm not a Trump defender, but what I'm saying is this has gone on forever. Negative campaigning is what Everybody does.
Yes.
They want to stoke fear. And this is Saul Alinsky 101. Identify and freeze your opponent and make people afraid of them. Now, for 120 years, the national pastime of the United States was what, Joe? You and me.
Baseball.
Baseball. And then since the advent of the smartphone and instant news on your phone, it became, in my view, confirmation bias. Right?
Yeah.
But now confirmation bias is being challenged by catastrophizing. People love to catastrophize. This is the end of the world. This is the end of democracy. This is the end of life as we know it. Things will change like we have never seen them before. Right? And to tell you the truth, I think people are heavily manipulated by the media they consume, which is targeted to make them freak out to do things that the freaker outers want them to do. Right.
So I agree with you. Fundamentally what you're saying, I agree with. But where I started to get nervous was the people who seemed to be catastrophizing this were and I'm not saying even in the past, say, 3 days, but early, like a week ago when the tariffs were originally announced, that this was, I believe, moronic, stupid, hellish. This was going to wreck us. This was going to change the way we live. These are people whose business it is, very similar to yours, Hugh, who have spent their lifetime dealing with this, who were at the top of the game. That previously, and this is from all sides, political ideologies, and I think. So, yes, I understand there is catastrophizing and there is an understanding, but a lot of that was based on looking, you know, you read something and say, well, we talked to 300 economists, both liberal and conservative, and they all thought, this isn't the way, this is what we shouldn't be doing.
And I think that's to some extent correct. In other words, it's correct to try to assess the current economic policies that we're seeing out of Washington. I don't want to use the word moronic, but that's probably a good word. Let me just add something. It's just important. And that is, we actually have ways of quantifying this. And in other words, quantifying the sentiment all right across the board, but certainly starting with stock prices or with stock investors. I do that, and I don't only do the work, but I watch the work very carefully. And it's interesting, and we call it the percentage of investors that are bullish and the percentage that are bearish. And sometimes they reach an emotional extreme where they're way too positive, an emotional extreme where they're way too negative. Now, you might say, based on what Bob said, is that maybe, or what we've heard here, what Joe said, is that we might be in an emotional extreme now where it's an overwhelming number of people that are catastrophic about what's going on. You'd be surprised. The numbers tell you that's not the case. It's actually somewhere in the middle, and it's headed in the direction where everybody's going to be bearish. And I might add, and it will be at an emotional extreme, and I might add, that's an important indicator, or I think it's an important and useful indicator as to when we're going to see a turn. Because when everybody gets on the bearish side of things, and we quantify it, we have those numbers down, when everybody gets on the bearish side of things, there ain't anybody else left to get bearish and to sell stocks. That's a good time. You know what I'm saying.
Yeah, life is very hard these days. I mean, I will say, because people are easily whipsawed. And if there's one thing I learned in my time in government and politics is, it is good advice to not let yourself get whipsawed by the news cycle. The news cycle is largely driven by what happened yesterday, when the most important thing is what's going to happen tomorrow, right? And, you know, I don't know, right? I've tried very hard to learn how to see into the future, and I can't do it. And you are brilliant. You have made a solid gold name for yourself in this sector, right? Hugh Johnson is like the Emmis, right? But you don't know. As much as you know, you don't know. And there isn't a single person in your business who knows. So if you want to say 300 economists from both sides, how can they all be wrong? I'm going to say, how can they all be right?
No, that's true.
Right.
Well, that's
so,
true.
So this.
But it's odd to see consensus on anything, and when you see consensus, it's like, oh, okay.
But well, you can okay, follow
and then,
indicators.
And then
like
you know,
he does.
Let's wait and see. This game isn't over. Joe, we're both. Are you a baseball fan?
Yeah, I love
you're
baseball.
A baseball.
I love baseball.
You're a baseball fan.
If I could work in baseball, I'd be working in baseball.
You never mind. I was been a Yankee fan all my life, and that's why.
Oh, you and I really liked you.
Yankee fan. Therese, you're a Red Sox fan. I'm a Mets fan.
She goes on the bullish side.
You're a Philly fan. Look at this. So it's a good thing
I've
that we're sitting
t-shirt. I'm
across
for the Red
from
Sox.
One another.
Because
you and I can't reach each other to hit each other.
Yeah, that's
and
it.
You two can't reach each other to hit each other. So
I still like him, even though he's a Yankees fan.
All the good rivalries in here. But, you know, you have to wait till the game is over to see the final score. And all these things, these are all innings, half innings, at-bats in a game, right? Trump says 3 months. We're going to pause these for 3 months. Well, we know Trump. He could pause them for 3 days.
But see, that's...
He could pause them for,
Bob,
for
that's the issue.
23 months.
What does business need?
Business needs certainty.
There you go.
Yeah, you can't get it. You can't get it in life.
But,
this is people.
But what... What you,
there is no certainty
what you
with people.
What you described earlier about the time horizon, all I could think of is, and it's 3 months, maybe more, maybe less, what about the farmers? What do they know to plant or not plant right now, right? So they're going to lose a year of crops because of this indecision. But it's not just they're not just facing the indecision of these tariffs. They are facing the elimination of USAID, where billions of dollars, $2.1 billion in food was bought from American farmers for those programs. They're facing the realistic cuts in the programs of farm-to-table school lunch programs and school breakfast programs. There are a whole series of things that aren't feelings. They are facts, which they are under attack in all different directions. And now... They don't know how to plant. They don't know if they're planting government planting programs because they're all on pause. So what happens to our agriculture industry in the United States? At the same time where Ukraine, the breadbasket of Europe, is also under siege. These are all factors that drive these charts. I mean, your charts are good. Yes, 20-year time horizons. Not everyone has that. And on top of the trade uncertainty, you have all of these deep cuts that have already happened and anticipated cuts. What happens with these Medicaid cuts? It hurts the individual, but it hurts the hospital. And what happens if it's the rural hospital and that shuts down and the rural hospital is the economic driver for that community?
If you see the way hospitals are shaking down the government for money, they could use a little hurting. Hospitals are among the biggest scammers of government programs, and they have turned it into a Michelangelo and Da Vinci like art form in the state we live in.
Okay, let's try this. What about
your hospital may vary?
Yes, your hospital. What about funding? What about funding government government funding for research, both government and academic sector research, which is what makes us the leader in the world in innovation, because that sparks and drives innovation. You get discovery in the universities, and you get translation into new industries, and that's how you get new companies.
You know, you're continuing to make a really good case that public policy as practiced currently in Washington, we used the word moronic before. You're using
Joe did. You said you wouldn't say it, but maybe you might.
I wouldn't say it, but I'd probably go along with it. You're raising all sorts of comments on issues that are just not sensible.
Because it's happening at the trade war is happening at the same time as we're weakening our ability to bring back manufacturing. If you want to bring back manufacturing, you don't do it by stopping job training. You don't do it by stopping funding of innovation, which will allow the better, more efficient, more effective manufacturing.
And
they're
Trump
happening
will
at the
tell
same
you,
time.
I okay, love draining on. The swamp. He used that in his first term. He's using a variation of that in his second term. He doesn't agree with you. He doesn't believe what you're saying. I do. He doesn't. That's what our political system's all about.
All right.
Different views.
Let me take a break. When we come back, we have a lot of letters, and we'll get to those. And we welcome yours, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. You know, Ray, somebody could buy the Linda and we could have a steel cage match in there. That'd be great. Really good. Yeah, it's a good idea, right? What do you think? Yeah,
isn't that at the wrestling match where they announced the tariffs? Isn't that where they did it?
That's pretty much. All right, we'll take a break. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion going on. I mean, we didn't stop for you. We went out to commercial. They just kept going. It was great. We'll try to bring you up to speed here in just a moment. Let me tell you who's on our program. Bob Bellafiore, communications expert and founder and president of Stanhope Partners. We also welcome public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, chairman and chief investment officer at Hugh Johnson Advisors in Albany. Hugh Johnson, I put on the rundown yesterday that you were going to be on, and everybody was like, "Oh my God, is it the Hugh Johnson is going to be on? The Hugh Johnson?" And we were all very excited that you're here. Yes, very cool, and we thank you very much for taking the time out.
Do we need to have a disclaimer that says nothing that Hugh says here can be constituted as investment advice or prospective? We need like some SEC disclaimer here.
He knows the verbiage on that. He certainly,
because if I was a person listening, I certainly wouldn't do anything based on anything we say.
Yeah, well,
nothing I say. All I want to say is I don't know what I'm talking about. I just have
questions. That's the first point in time I'm going to agree with you, Teresa.
On investing.
I did want to sell it. Anyway, let's.
All right.
Hold it and buy the dip. Buy the dip. That's all I know. Buy the dip. Wherever the dip is.
Go to letters. These are letters from our listeners, and we welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. Jennifer says, tariffs are the Trump tax that regular American folks will pay. The world is looking away from the U.S. and towards each other. Example, Canada and Europe strengthening ties with Canada, reducing barriers among provinces. There is no need for this trade war. This is a wholly invented Trump disaster. The U.S. could easily have enough money for everything they want if the mega wealthy just paid a fraction of their share of taxes. Sane washing is right. Teresa, and your testiness is much appreciated.
thank you.
But what about that? I think this is a popular thought among people that are listening. That is this the creation of a problem that now you go and solve?
Well, yeah, there is a problem, but the problem. See, she's absolutely right. And she's right by saying it's effectively a tax on consumers. It's a tax on businesses also. Businesses will pay part of the tariffs. But it doesn't matter. The point is that it is effectively, the tariffs are effectively a tax. And she's absolutely right. It's for a purpose. And we talked about that before. And the purpose is clearly, I think, in my judgment, I think Teresa agrees, and I think Bob's essentially is signing on as well. And that's to find a way to finance the reduction or the extension of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, or the tax reductions which were passed in 2017 and sunset at the end of 2025, to extend them. And that's going to require, obviously, some money to do that, because it means $3 trillion in increase, $3 trillion using the Congressional Budget Office's estimates, $3 trillion in an increased deficit in 10 years. Money's got to come from somewhere, and it's going to come from, hopefully, the tariff or the taxes on individuals and companies. Hopefully that will be enough. If you look at the record, unfortunately, it won't work. It won't be enough. And so she's absolutely right. It's going to be very difficult to finance those tax reductions, and those will be a hot subject of debate over the course of the next the near term as this budget gets discussed.
And the other place it's coming from, the House and Senate Republicans just passed this budget framework, and they intend for it to come from deep, deep cuts in all sorts of, whether it's agriculture programs, research funding, it's a veterans programs across the board. That's the other place it's coming from, and still it won't add up to be enough. And so they could be talking about modifying and only extending the tax cuts for those who make $500,000 or less or something like that.
That's
but they're
right.
not even beginning that conversation, mm-hmm. because those aren't his peeps.
David writes to us and says, the problem is not the feeling. The problem is the ridiculous action causing the feeling. You guys have missed the fact that shifting the tax burden from income taxes to tariffs is the most regressive thing that they could possibly do. People who pay a little to no income taxes will have huge amounts of tax increases, and this is all done so that billionaires can get the biggest tax cut in world history. So Republican, so, well, there's a word here about Republicans. Anyway, Donald Trump, Elon Musk, congressional Republicans destroying America. If an erratic maniac puts a gun to your head, you're going to have a bad feeling, but the problem you're having is not your bad feeling, it's that you have a gun in your face. All right. Very vivid.
I think that person should try decaf.
Yolanda says, how does Trump's tariffs benefit or help the working class people, Hugh?
You would hope, and this is all theory, that the tariffs will prevent us from buying a lot of things from other parts of the world, and therefore we'll have to find some ways here, this is called protectionism, find some way here to replace those things that we buy from other parts of the world, or that it will domesticize, if there is such a word, manufacturing, and that manufacturing will be helped in the U.S., and therefore it will lead to an increase in jobs in the U.S. It's really isolationism and protectionism.
Now, Teresa, you've made this point and similar about how it affects the working class, but I'm interested in your thoughts on that, Bob.
Yeah, I don't think returning manufacturing to the United States, increasing domestic manufacturing, needs to be something we have to do. The globalization of the economy has led to all kinds of issues with people wanting cheap stuff made in China with practically slave wages, which is something, frankly, the American left should be outraged about who is making the Nikes they buy from Amazon or from the sporting goods store.
Stop looking at my feet.
But that's why they believe targeted tariffs can address issues. Right?
Secondly, returning manufacturing to the United States is going to take more than tariffs. Why is manufacturing fled the United States? Because of the cost of developing projects in the United States, the cost of labor, the cost of environmental regulations, the cost of the environmental review process, barriers that are put up for every little thing, right? That is also makes it harder. It makes manufacturers say, why should I bother with a 10-year review process when I can just put it up in China in 20 minutes? Now, I'm exaggerating on the 20 minutes, but not on the 10 years, right? So returning manufacturing is more than just one thing. So to say tariffs are designed to return manufacturing, I would say it's tariffs plus all these other things that affect United States manufacturing. Two, you know, you can believe there's an end game. You cannot believe there's an end game, right? At the moment, given my level of power, I choose to believe there's an end game. Right, because I am a hopeful person.
Well, there's an end game. It's always an end game, right? It's just,
well, sometimes there's not an end game. You might say he's just going. These guys just hopping from lily pad to lily pad, and there's no idea where the other side of the lake is.
Yeah.
Right. So I choose to believe there's an end game. I choose to believe there's a strategy. I am fine with Canada and European nations coming closer together. Frankly, I think the world depends on Big Uncle Sam for too many things.
But we used to be involved in those discussions more than we are, it seems, now.
I think we're involved in plenty of discussions right now. If they want to go and make themselves stronger together, I think that's great. Because I don't think the American people, maybe not in the coast, maybe not in our listening area, but in most of the states of the country, would like America to spend more time, you can call it isolationism, protectionism, whatever you want, on American issues. Because, you know, we're sending money all over the world, but we can't get people in North Carolina back in their houses after a storm. And I think that is a disconnect.
They just cut FEMA funding.
That is it.
FEMA funding for people.
They've cut lots of funding. And, you know, every time somebody wants to cut government spending, everybody goes back to the intentions of the program.
But you just said helping people in North Carolina. That's recovering from a disaster. You know, they just stopped the support for North Carolina.
You can actually, what's being done here, when you think about it theoretically, is Trump is trying to, you're right. I mean, you would like to see manufacturing facilities, plants, business done here as opposed to other parts of the world. It's gone to other parts of the world because of relative labor union, labor rates, because of regulations that are onerous and difficult. And Trump's trying to circumvent all that. He's trying to simply say, we're going to impose tariffs, and that's going to get the manufacturing facilities relocated here. I'll tell you another way you could do it, but it's going to take an awful lot of time, and I don't think we have the patience. It's called free trade. It'll happen, and it'll happen over time. Believe me, there'll be pressure on the government. The government will make changes. Regulations will be changed. It will happen. Things will be relocated to the U.S. We've even seen it already where we've seen labor rates in different parts of the world start to come up and our labor rates stay okay. About the same. The gap or the differential between the two is closing, but it's not going to get closed to the extent that you would like to see or that it's going to actually have an effect on business or manufacturing. It's not going to have that effect for another 10 or 15 years. It'll happen, but it'll be 10 or 15 years if you have free trade. Well, if you don't have free trade, it won't happen.
Well, and that's the question. Is it short-term pain for long-term gain? Right?
That's a real question.
Right? And you know, right now the conversation is about the short-term pain. Now, we don't know if it's going to be short-term pain or long-term pain. All we know is that right now it's pain.
But the markets are telling you, you want some short-term pain, you're going to get it. And that's the problem. Well, that's the problem. You can have short-term pain. You can have economic policies that give you short-term pain. But the extent of the pain will inflict such pain on you that you're going to be very unhappy with the outcome.
So you're going to say that it's poison, not medicine.
Yeah. It has the. If you look at the message of the markets, Bob, the message of the markets, short-term, this is all short-term stuff, is very dire. It's saying, you see a lot of people, a lot of economists, a lot of very savvy, I think, professionals are forecasting that we're going to have a recession. And as you start to have a recession, it's very difficult. The dynamics are very difficult to change. It can last for a fairly long time. It's a very difficult situation. You don't want that. And what I'm simply saying is that I'd like to see this change. I'd like to see it change quickly. Donald Trump would like to see it change. Okay, that's fine. It's great. It's ambitious. But what I also say is I think there's a better way, but it takes longer, and there's less pain, and it's more sensible.
I would love to know the batting averages of the economists. Right?
But Bob, what about if I mean...
I actually have that.
Yeah, no, that's an important thing to know, right? What's the batting average?
But there has
it's
been...
It's not particularly good, and
You got guys with a bad prediction record predicting something. What am I supposed to think about their prediction?
Did you know who did the study to establish that economists tend to have not a particularly good record?
Hugh Johnson.
No.
Oh.
Economist.
Federal Reserve.
That's what I'm saying. 300 economists can't be wrong, but I'm not sure 300 economists can be right. Right? What's the old line? I'm looking for a one-handed economist.
Yeah.
But reshoring manufacturing, there has been an ongoing effort, Senator Schumer, others, for a decade to bring the chips.
Yes.
We saw it during the pandemic in a very dangerous way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than bolster and maybe accelerate that effort, what has Trump done? He's cut the funding. He's stopped that effort. There's been an effort to reshore. Solar panels were designed and developed in this country, and then we lost that to China. There has been a concentrated effort to bring that back. And a successful one.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this because I was involved in a solar program where we needed to buy them. And all sorts of incentives, worked with all the various components of that brought together. All the supports for that have now been cut. So is he really interested in bringing back money? I mean, it seems to me he's interested in his tax cuts. He doesn't want to bring back solar because he has his oil and gas buddies that, you know, they were his funders in the campaign, right? So he completely eliminates funding for all of this work that's sparking a clean energy economy, right? So what's he really after?
Tax cuts.
So let me ask a question that came up during the break, but I'd like to – we have Hugh for about 8 more minutes, so I would like to ask this. The depression, that word, a depression, has been used over the last several days. Should we be having a serious conversation and think on that?
Well, yes and no. The Economist magazine, which is highly respected, has brought the possibility up, and brought it up, quite frankly, four or five months ago, and did a really good job of describing the possibility. Yeah, we should have the discussion, if for no other reason than to have a really good discussion on a very important topic. I think, this is me personally, and it's me personally being coached by Professor Kindleberger, who unfortunately has left us, but Professor Kindleberger used to be the head at MIT and wrote Manias, Panics, and Crashes, which I think is the best book ever written on the world of finance. And basically, he argues against, in the world in depression, 1929 to 1939, against, he talks about the dissimilarities between now and the 1930s that really tell you that it's unlikely to happen again. The number one dissimilarity, according to Kindleberger and myself, is not money supply. It's not the fact that the stock market declined and everybody stopped buying because of a decline in their wealth. It was primarily by Hyman Minsky, who from Bard College, who was a wonderful economist, and he argued, and he, I think, argued very persuasively, that it was credit. As soon as the stock market declined and people said their worth started to dry up, they stopped borrowing money and spending money, and it was really credit issues. And right now, we do not have the kind of shrinking of credit in the country. The economy is run on money and credit. Keep that in mind. We don't have a shrinkage in credit to the extent that it would cause something that would be similar to 1930s. So I think the dissimilarities tell me it's not going to be 1930s, but we should have the discussion, if not for no other reason than to learn a lot about something very important.
Let me ask this question from JD, who says, please ask Hugh Johnson to explain why Russia was not included in the group of 70 countries that were hit with tariffs.
I can't. I can't explain that. They're not the only ones. There are five of them, as you know.
Yes.
Belarus, and I can't remember them all. But I don't know.
Now, what I had heard, and which seemed like a somewhat logical explanation, was because of the...
But because they had embargoes, but he's lifted a lot of those.
Yes, but there were some, so...
That's what they're saying, that there already are all sorts of constraints on them because of Ukraine, and so no need to do that. But what about Hungary? What about
Belarus?
Yeah, I mean there were some similarities in
that.
Well, I would say he's playing a different game with Russia than he's playing with China, and these other countries. He's got a different, you know, it doesn't fit into the deal with Russia strategy.
And what's the game with the country with just penguins?
Couldn't tell you.
I want to go there, by the way. I want to see a real life penguin in its habitat.
Go to a zoo.
You'd like me to go right
Teresa,
now, right,
Mom? Go.
They're fabulous creatures. They
I just wanted to make Bob laugh.
I know.
Huh?
They are monogamous. You gotta love a monogamous species.
Anyway, I'm wasting our valuable time.
They mate for life.
Let me ask this question, which is, I don't know when I get it and I understand what you're saying, Bob. And I know how you mean it, but I automatically, and this is just maybe just me, but I automatically flinch when we use the word game. Like it's a game. I understand how you mean. I get it, but it's just I think there are often times where I feel like those who are actually taking action indeed feel like it's a game.
Okay, so what do I mean by game? He has a different strategy for different things, and you have to have different strategies for different parts of the country, for economics, for geopolitics, for defense. For all these things, and that is the tremendous difficulty of being in the White House, is that you have this big board, right? It's like the big board in George C. Scott's big board in Dr. Strangelove. You got all these countries, and they're all connected by webs, and every time you pull on one, another one reacts, and you have to be really careful on how you play them off one another. You can't just do the same thing for everybody. So it's a different strategy, a different approach, because he has different aims with Russia than they would have with China.
That would be fun. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
If it were just Russia and China, but it's 70 other countries. But what it seems to me is he's had, you know, like this, what some people describe as a pre-80s view of the world, where it cemented his view on tariffs and not a more globalized world than we have now. So he is running with his vengeance campaign in one direction and his tariffs campaign in another, because he thinks that the vengeance just because he's angry, the tariffs because it gets him to his tax cuts. But in the meantime, you have Russ Vogt sitting at OMB with the vice president and the whole group of Project 2025 people who are making these cuts where he's signing off on it, often in wonderment when he signs his executive. Oh, that one looks interesting. Like he's not even sure what it is.
About the machine.
But all right.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I talk about the past? I apologize.
No.
I apologize for raising
good
way to interrupt the conversation.
How we got here.
All right, go ahead.
But the reality is, the cuts that they are making have, in conjunction with this trade war, across the global trade war, they caused the rest of the world to not have confidence in our country, and they are impacting people who live in this country, many of whom are working class or live on the margins. Our veterans, our nurses, our working people, our farmers, our small businesses, which, as you well know, are the backbone of our country. These are long, they have to play out over the long term, but these businesses don't have long term. Our farmers don't have a long term. And a lot of people are getting hurt. And sure, that's making them nervous, but it's also making them bankrupt.
I just have one minute left.
I'm interrupting.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to, I want to thank Hugh Johnson for being here, Chairman and Chief Investment Officer at Hugh Johnson Advisors in Albany. It's been a great honor to have you on our program. Thank you so much for explaining all of this. And we'll be okay, right? Everything will be all right?
Absolutely. In the past, we've always come out, and we've come out in good shape, and I think we'll do it this time. I wish I could tell you when. I can't. I could give you a statistically sound guess, but that's only a statistically sound guess. And I think it'll be within the next couple of years. We'll be coming out the other side of this, and everybody will be happy, and maybe we'll have a different administration.
Hugh Johnson, thank you very much for being with us. An absolute delight. Hugh's going to leave us. That'll leave Bob and Teresa in the studio. That should be fun.
My right hand doesn't work, so you win.
we'll take a break, and we'll return and deal with other issues coming up. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. having a conversation with Bob, and Bob just turns and goes, don't worry about it. I'm just being a pain in the ass. As was I, you know, right? Exactly.
People are entirely too nice and cordial to each other. We need to be able to be a pain in the neck.
That's the problem.
And yet still be
friends.
Well,
that's what I really do try on this show as much as possible, to have people as calm and be nice to each other. But
public discourse. So I'm an old guy. There once was a time when you could fight like heck on the floor of the Senate,
yes,
or over an issue, and then go out and get a beer. And what has happened now is the other side has been demonized in a mindless chase for clicks and sound bites and attention from the extreme ends that control the discourse, which is to say, CNN, NBC on one side, CNN, MSNBC on one side, and Fox on the other.
Right.
Right. So, right, the old line, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, right? The noisiest, sharpest-tongued person gets the attention. So, and you do that by demonizing, not only saying they're wrong, but they're wrong and they're evil.
Right.
They're wrong and they're trying to kill you. And that happens on both sides, and it has destroyed the ability to have a serious conversation about where the most of the country is, which is somewhere on a football field, somewhere between the 35-40 yard lines. But all the conversation happens inside the 20 yard lines.
Yeah.
To extend the
red zone.
I
revenants.
Totally agree with you on this. I completely agree, and it's a problem. And it has to be figured out that people have to be able to talk and debate, because that's how you figure out what the consensus is, if that's what you're doing it for. I mean, I work for Senator Kennedy. He and Senator Hatch, Republican from Utah, they would be on the Senate floor. they would be, Senator Hatch wasn't yelling, Kennedy often was, but they were debating, he and Senator McCain.
Then they would
leave, and then they'd be chums having dinner. And it wasn't they were disingenuous, it's they were discussing, they had real policy differences, but they were friends, and they would work through, and that's why Kennedy was so successful at getting legislation enacted, because he would always work to find who is a Republican partner in this.
Ralph Wolf and Sam Sheepdog. Do you know what the reference?
No.
Hello, Ralph. Hello, Sam.
Good morning. Morning, Ralph. Morning, Sam. You had a coyote,
right.
Wolf coyote.
Right.
It was basically the same character as Wile E. Coyote, but
it was
had
a Hanna-Barbera.
But it had a red nose. This is Warner Brothers. This is going back to the 40s.
I saw it all the time growing up.
Yeah. Good morning.
I miss Morning Ralph.
Morning Sam. And then they would check in on the time clock, and then they would go and they would go to kill each other, fight each other within the forest,
right.
and in the farm. And then at the end of the day, they would clock out, and then they'd go talking and have a lovely conversation on the way. And then that's sort of I think that is exactly what you were just describing.
Right. Well, I spent 3 years at a job bringing people together all over the country on public policy issues, bringing people of opposite views into the same place to discuss them with their elected official to see if you can find some consensus. Heated conversation, but bringing those ideas together.
Are you too testy to do that?
No.
I think it's passion, not
passion.
Yeah, that's
no,
right.
No, no.
Yeah.
But I do think this is a big problem, and you're not going to like the next thing I said. But I think Newt Gingrich, where he kind of demonized Republicans talking to Democrats. I think that he wasn't the first one to do that, but in a big way, and made it almost bad if you work together. And I do think that's so on both sides, there need to figure out a way to come together and talk to each other and work with each other.
In your day job, Bob, you must work on these issues. I mean, this must be something that fundamentally what you have to do.
Yeah, you have to understand where the other side is coming from. So the first thing is understanding what the other side's arguments are. This is as old as the hills.
Right.
Understanding where the other side is coming from, understanding the other side's, if there is another side, understanding their motivations and why they are pushing for something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And why this kind of thing is attractive to elected officials. Because until you understand that, you can't possibly figure out what the road forward is.
Right.
And it doesn't mean, in the case you're talking about in the Senate, it's not that they're disingenuous about the issue, but America lives in the middle.
Right.
America does not live on the wings. The noisemakers live on the wings. And Gingrich had a hand in this, and then there came the Tea Party, which made it possible, and then you got the left got its own, working family, whatever you want to call it, other side of thing. And now it's gotten to the point where if you're a liberal media outlet and you have a staunch fire-breathing conservative. No one ever says staunch fire-breathing liberal, by the way. They just say staunch fire-breathing conservative on your show.
I'll show you a million letters where that's exactly what they call us.
Well, don't just read what I send you.
No, okay, that's true.
Demonizing Nancy Pelosi, Ted Kennedy were forever. Go ahead.
And then the effort, and then what becomes is deplatforming.
Right.
How dare you give them airtime?
Airtime.
Because you can't even listen to what the other person says. You have a conversation on a college campus, and my son told me about a story about this when he was at the University of Oklahoma, and on a center-right group he was part of. And a woman a student just stormed out and says, I can't listen to this anymore. Like, people don't want to hear what the other side has to say.
Which is problematic.
Because they are offended and triggered by it. Well, half the country does not think like you do.
Yeah.
So you got to have an open mind. You have to be willing to have these conversations. I have been friends for 42 years with a buddy of mine from college, and we agree on nothing. You know the guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
We agree on this is Steve Greenberg.
Right.
We absolutely agree on almost nothing.
Right.
Since college. Right.
Except for your deep, dear friends.
Except
on policy. You don't agree on policy.
We don't agree. Yeah, and maybe
baseball.
He's a Yankee fan. I'm a Met fan. He's a Coke guy. I'm a Pepsi guy. He's a Ranger guy. I'm an Islander guy.
Right.
It just go down the list. And we have managed to keep our friendship alive because we had said we're going to disagree. He worked for Carl McCall's campaign in 2002. I worked for George Pataki's, right? Like,
yeah,
that's when I was working with him for him.
So it's you have to be able to have this personal relationship and not make the politics personal. But right now, there's currency in making it personal.
But you will agree. I think you will agree that George Pataki was a very different politician of a Republican who could get elected in a very blue state.
Well, yeah, and it was a lot of it was timing, but it was also his approach. You know, his approach was, and I'd love to see this in D.C., here's what I want to get done, right? He would say, this is the goal. Can I get you to agree with the goal?
I mean, right? He won two terms.
Three terms.
Three terms. And certainly there were criticisms, but is not thought of generally as a pariah of in the history of New York State.
Environmentalist.
No, he was a conservative leaning middle of the road guy. Yeah. I mean, he was
where are those folks now that could run in a similar campaign? Is that possible? Because and I don't even mean this in disrespect, but there's a huge difference between George Pataki and the last gubernatorial candidate that the Republicans ran, Lee Zeldin.
Well, the dynamic has changed. I mean, Lee Zeldin far outperformed the enrollment difference. I mean, Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1.
He
won by like 6-7 points.
No doubt.
Because
but ideologically, they're very different.
Yeah, they're very different guys. And I don't know. I think there is a fundamental change in the mindset of how politics is run in both parties. And it is nasty, and it is vindictive, and it is, I'll use a term from your people, Teresa. It is othering other guy. Yeah. It is othering them. It is labeling them, making them evil. This is both parties.
What the Republicans are doing to people on university campuses, please. But I had an experience years ago, and I was working for the House Judiciary Committee, and we were trying to move the major, I'm an old person, so the 84 crime package. And Nightline, Ted Koppel, Nightline was a big deal at that time. And mm-hmm. my boss was the chairman of the subcommittee that was the lead in moving this bill through. And so we were in negotiations, House Senate negotiations, final negotiations on the bill, trying to finalize it. Go on Nightline. Very heated discussion, and he held back a little bit. And this one, the Republican, was really just going after him.
Yeah.
And so after we left, I was walking out, and I said, well, why did you let him go like that? He said, well, the difference between us and him, Teresa, is he's going home, and we're going to finish the bill.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
All that rhetoric stuff was fine. Except for it wasn't going to get the bill done.
Yeah, he was putting on a TV show.
He was putting on a TV show.
Yeah, putting on a TV show.
Well,
and I'm not saying just Republicans do that. I'm
not
saying
everybody
they both.
Does that.
But there's a difference between the people who talk and the people who do.
AOC is the biggest TV show on the left. She's a TV show.
Well, I think recently with, certainly both Bernie and AOC have found, I'm going to say niche.
Well, you know I have an issue with Senator Sanders in the sense that I think this is part of the problem with him is that it's what's the legislative track record, right? And well, I understand the rhetorical. I know
get ready for the letters. You thought they don't like you. Go after Bernie.
Yeah. No, I mean, I also don't buy on Amazon and I don't buy Nike either. So,
no, but my
on the opposite end.
But my point, which I'm struggling to remember what it was.
I think it's important what he says, what they say. It's important to have that as part of the conversation.
Oh.
But at some point you gotta get to legislating.
So my question here is the word I have heard on this show used by everybody, and not just our panelists, but in our articles and in the media, and I've heard this word more times in the last 2 months than I've heard in my entire lifetime, and that is the word performative.
Right.
And so, and that's what we're talking about, right? Is this performative?
Yeah.
Whether you talk about the 20-yard line working to the right or the left, and the 20-yard line, I mean that's what it is. And but it becomes more of a dog and pony show than it is an actual exercise in trying to get something done.
And And that's right. So my general theory is, in a democracy, the people get the government they deserve, right?
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
No, they do. They do because they vote for it, or they don't vote. I mean,
they didn't vote. That's right.
Well,
that's like
then that means
no,
they got the.
Right.
No,
that's
I agree.
By not voting,
I agree.
You get the government you deserve.
Yes, I agree.
Right?
I
by voting, you get the government you deserve.
Believe in the democratic system, and I right. agree with what you're saying.
You know, at some time in the last 15 years, maybe this has been going on longer. The American people decided that the entertainers they see on TV are the people they're going to follow. Right. So like so my general quip is when people started caring what Jimmy Kimmel thought about healthcare was the day we launched Donald Trump's campaign. Because Donald Trump was the ultimate entertainer. And this is a little bit like, remember like your mother would say, you want to cry, you're going to cry, I'll give you something to cry
about?
Yeah,
because he talked about his own son's health issues that got people focused.
I'm saying because he's
that,
a comedian.
I mean, I'm just asking.
I'm saying because he's a stand-up comedian. Yeah. I don't care what his story was. He was an entertainer.
It was really a question because I don't watch a lot of that. I don't know the TV
references. I don't watch
TV
it either.
References.
I see what's in the stories. And he's
so was that you meant when he started talking about it? I was really, it was just like I'm trying to frame what you're saying. You mean like when he was talking about his son being
when
sick
he was
with
making,
heart issues?
Well, you're trying to make political statements and people cared what Jimmy Kimmel said about, that's my microcut. That's my example. When he talked, okay. when
yeah.
we cared what stand-up comedians said about
I wasn't questioning, I was just trying to
politics.
Understand what you were saying.
Yeah,
sorry.
It's we are, this is the ultimate triumph of us and People magazine. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
and the American people said, I really care about entertainers and eyeballs and people who can capture my attention. And then the cosmos said, oh, yeah, I'm going to give you the ultimate entertainer who's the king of eyeballs, who's Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And you know, and the Democrats didn't know how to deal with it.
Well,
so,
I mean, no.
Well, this is because. I mean, Murdoch owns Fox News, and that drives the whole agenda that he has. I mean,
no,
there's a lot of complicated pieces to it.
I do yeah. agree with the statement that Donald Trump possesses a skill that I have never seen right. replicated in the sense of being able to control the narrative at all times over,
oh,
by the
true.
Way, over a decade. I mean, politically, a decade. And has never moved off of that, and is very keen on, you know, when he says things at the end of even at the much talked about meeting with the president of Ukraine of saying, well, you know, that was good television. Well,
right.
yeah, I mean that's that
quiet and, part out loud.
And
yeah.
and by the way, not wrong.
Right. Well, I mean, I really think what's going on right now is not so much. Well, it is a lot of Donald Trump, but the part of our system that's not working is I've said this over and over, it's the Republicans in the House and the Senate not exercising their First Amendment rights and responsibilities to be a check on some of the stuff that he's doing. I think that's what's going on.
Well, they're going against the ratings king.
Yeah.
And you know...
But what's interesting, I was hearing an analysis of this the other day that I want to think more about, which I thought was intriguing, that because people are, so, you know, his power has been the power to primary on the right, you know, to get his right base all worked up. But because of these decisions, they're hurting the moderates. And so now it's more likely that that's not what the candidates are going to be afraid of. It's not the people on the right, because that's... Some of them are shifting because they're being hurt by a lot of these policies. Well, so that power will be in some ways diminished.
We'll see
if that's true. I don't know if that's true.
And when you start to hurt when you start to hurt politicians politically, they need to make a decision.
Right.
Of whether, you know,
these House and Senate Republicans.
House and Senate Republicans, House and Senate Democrats, town council Republicans
right.
and Democrats.
Yeah.
Right? If they view their job as to get reelected, they have to be responsive to their district.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a decision that they all have to. You got to understand, everybody in public life has agency to make a decision about how what they do and what they say, and they can decide is their goal to go with the flow or are they going to find a way to push back, right? So there are, you know, in the end, yeah, there were these global societal forces. I think the American culture has gone down the toilet. I think politicians I think if you hooked up an IQ reader to politicians in the 70s and 80s and politicians now, you get a much lower rating.
I don't know if that's, I don't know.
Yeah, I know. I think there's a loss of intellectual heft. I think there's a loss of seriousness.
There's a loss of experience, that's for sure, and seriousness. Really understanding how the House and Senate work. That's
right.
For sure.
No, not at all. But we're desperately late for a break.
No.
So we're going to do that. And when we come back, we'll wrap up the show. And we'll finish with some closing thoughts. We'll do that right after this short break. Good morning. As we close out this edition of the Roundtable panel, Bob Bellafiore is with us, communications expert and founder, president of Stanhope Partners, and public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois with us. We welcome your letters in our final moments. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So just in the time we were talking, and I think having a good conversation, I just wanted to. So Wayne writes and says, the other side encouraged and condoned a mob attacking Congress to overturn an election. The other side is using the power of government to take revenge on their political enemies. There are many people who believe that.
What do you think about this executive order against Krebs, the guy who was the election cybersecurity guy?
I don't know anything about it, so I don't.
Last night, Trump signed an executive order.
Yeah.
Against, in his previous administration, I can't remember his first name, his last name is Krebs. He was a cybersecurity expert overseeing
Chris Krebs,
the election security, cybersecurity.
Yeah.
And he said publicly that he thought that the election was fair and safe from his cybersecurity perspective. And Trump got mad at him for that. So now he's back in power and he just signed an executive order directing the Justice Department to investigate him.
To order a probe.
Yeah. I don't know anything about it, and the one thing I would tell every client I've ever worked with is, if you don't know anything about it and all you're getting is one presentation of it, yeah. You're silly to have an opinion. So I don't know. I'd have to learn more about it. I don't know.
But the president directing the Justice Department to... But
I love you. I respect what you're saying, but I don't know if what you're saying is fairness, is fair and true.
Should the president direct the Justice Department to do an investigation?
I don't know what the facts are of the story. I'm not dodging. I just mean it would be silly. It's foolish to comment on something with an opinion, to answer the question, what do you think, if you don't have facts other than ones presented to you in the context of the question.
But I meant broader picture, because typically the president doesn't direct the Justice Department. They're supposed to be independent, right? Anyway, go ahead.
No, executive agency. I'm not a constitutional scholar to know what those separations are. What was your question, Joe?
I forgot. I was reading the listener letter about January 6th and the concerns and I was wondering what your thoughts were on,
on
that.
January 6th thing was awful. There's no excuse for what happened on January 6th. What I will say is, and I know I annoy people when I say it, is that the whole country knew about January 6th and everything that came out of it and the impeachment, and they still elected Donald Trump. So the American people told you.
This
time around, yeah. They knew all about it, and they still elected him. Now, why was that? That's a separate conversation for, in the immortal words of David Byrne, my God, how did I get here? In terms of using the power...
You're not my beautiful wife.
Exactly. Right.
I'll just let the day go by.
No. I got you. Hey, is that an ethnic slur?
This must be some sort of TV or
no.
Movie
it's a music reference.
It's a Talking Heads song.
Yeah.
Teresa, get out.
No, my friends
get
got me
bubble,
People
man.
Magazine because I didn't. I'm so culturally uninformed.
No. You're not going to see David Byrne in People Magazine. In fact, maybe. I think he'd be anti People Magazine.
Well, that's true.
This was back in the 80s and 90s. They said if I was going to be in this business, I had a better. Anyway,
go home and go to Apple Music or Spotify or whatever you have, or listen to Talking Heads. Stop Making Sense.
I'll make you a mixtape.
I've heard of Talking Heads.
Okay,
Giuseppe.
Good.
There you go. as far as using the power of the federal government against your enemies, tell me something new. I mean, we've memory-holed the Obama IRS going after conservative nonprofits. We've memory-holed so many things that we think that everything is new because we're wrapped up in news cycle. When you got
comparing them going after nonprofits with going? With the freeing the January 6th people?
No, what I'm saying is the question from Joe was, I've already said about January 6th. What I said is using the tools of the federal government to punish your political enemies.
I see. Yeah. We're going to have to let it go there. And I know no one's happy about that. But that we're,
you know
we're,
how
we're,
hard
we're,
it is for me to let that go.
I know.
Well, I'm totally
I know.
Happy. You said day go by, and I got to go buy lunch. Now I'm hungry. And I got to go listen to some David Byrne in the car.
That's right. Oh, God. Yeah, put in American Utopia. Good, fabulous. Good stuff.
American Utopia.
My wife and I saw him do that show at the Egg.
Yes.
When they were running it before it hit Broadway. Unbelievable.
No, it's just mind-blowing. It's amazing.
Went from pardoning January 6th to
stuff
something utopia.
To stuff that's everlasting, which is music.
I love music. James Taylor.
Yeah.
Well, we talk about him. I could enjoy that conversation.
You know what? We're going to make you a fan. We're going to make you a David Byrne fan by the time we're done here.
It'll be a quiz.
Bob and I will work on this.
I'll probably listen to some Talking Heads.
Yeah. Quiz next time we're on the show.
All right.
Name that lyric.
Ray's laughing at the thought of me naming a lyric.
We're out of time. My thanks to everybody. Bob, Teresa, you're both great. Love you. Thank you. Thanks again to Hugh Johnson, by the way.
Oh, my God.
He was wonderful. We'll be back right after this.